broadcast, call 510-848-6767, extension 625. An archive of our recent shows can be heard on the web at www.flashpoints.net. Many thanks to Don Lionheart, our web maestro, and thank you for listening.
At 9.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Coming up next, Queer Voices.
Hello and welcome to the Monday edition of the KPFT Sports Brief. In rugby union news, in the Texas Rugby Union over the weekend, in the men's collegiate Division I D side, Texas A&M defeated Rice University 51-15. In the Division II A side, the Dallas Athletic defeated Arlington 10-5. In the men's Division II B side, Dallas Athletic defeated Arlington 14-0. In international news, in a rugby union, John Wilkinson will lead England for the first time on this coming Sunday after Martin Johnson was ruled out of the RBS Six Nations clash with Italy at Twickenham. Johnson has a slight Achilles injury, which coach Clave Woodward said needed rest in time for England's game against Scotland on the 22nd of March. In football news, Steven Gerrard and Michael Owen combined to give Liverpool a 2-0 victory over Manchester United to win the English League Cup on Sunday. In ice hockey news, in the American Hockey League, the Houston Aeros defeated the Milwaukee Admirals 4-3 on Saturday and lead the Western Division of the Western Conference with 87 points, 19 points ahead of Chicago. They take on San Antonio tonight. In boxing news, Roy Jones Jr. became the second lightweight champion to win the heavyweight title as he defeated John Ruiz to win the World Boxing Association heavyweight belt on Saturday night in a 12-round decision. And in Olympic news, Lloyd Ward quit as the CEO of the United States Olympic Committee. This comes after evidence of fraud and corruption was blamed on him. And in cricket news over the weekend, Australia defeated England by 2 wickets, and India defeated Pakistan by 6 wickets. We wait for South Africa-Sri Lanka match to see if South Africa goes on in the Cricket World Cup. And this has been Richard Hanna with the Monday edition of the KPFT Sports Brief.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Walensky.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Joe Devlin.
And Glenn Holt.
And we're back to our normal schedule, being here on right at 8 o'clock.
How about that?
Yes, and... It's Queer TV season with Six Feet Under and Queers.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Got them both last night.
Yes. Well, I fell asleep to one of them. just too late for me.
I watched Anna Nicole last night.
That would put me asleep.
Well, that was a good question because I stood it for about 5 minutes and then I had to turn it off. It was really bad.
Well, speaking of bad things, who's coming to town?
Oh, Fred Phelps, Mr. Westboro Baptist Church. He will be protesting at NASA and then throughout Kingwood starting Friday of next week. He is upset with Kingwood College for putting on a production of the Laramie Project. He's upset with NASA for allowing domestic partner benefits. And he's upset with an assorted amount of churches in Kingwood for not protesting the Laramie Project.
Well, and to be a little bit more specific, Tim Overbrook was very nice to put this up on Hannet, which is Houston Activist Network. March 7th from 1 to 2 p.m. he's going to be at NASA in Clear Lake. March 7th at 7:30 to 8. Well, that's a long thing at Kingwood College. On the 8th, he'll be at St. John's Venedity Catholic Church in West Houston at 5 to 5:30. March 8th from 7:30 to 8, Kingwood College. March 9th, Christ the King Lutheran Church from 7:50 to 8:20. Boy, these are really short.
He's trying to catch them as they're going into services and into the play.
Yes, on March 9th, First Presbyterian Church in Kingwood. March 9th, 9:45 a.m. to 10:15 p.m., Good Shepherd Church in Kingwood. And on March 9th from 10 10:20 to 11 a.m. Kingwood United Methodist Church.
I hope okay. they've been warned.
They have. They actually, I talked to some of them today, and they all basically are treating it as a joke and said they're not going to really do anything about it.
How's he going to do NASA? That's a big place, and isn't it hard to get close enough?
Yeah, he'll be 4 miles down the road in Galveston somewhere, I guess, or in Clear, you know, some street in Clear Lake.
He might as well pick at the Contiki.
I know.
Well, it's kind of like I explained it to my sister. What he does is street theater. It should not be taken seriously.
I'd say that.
Well, and on tonight's show, besides This Way Out with all of its wonderful segments, David Elliott will be joining us from Washington and talking about the peace movement within our community. And we also will have Alyssa Hill, who will tell us about the 14th Annual AIDS Walk in Houston, which will be this Sunday, March 9th at Sam Houston Park, and it begins at 8 a.m. And then in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to be talking to the Montrose Writers Guild.
That'll be interesting.
They're going to give us some other sample writing.
We also are going to have Mr. Ken Jones on tonight to talk to us about HIV drugs.
And then Randall White is going to be talking to us via phone. He's a Dallas-based actor and writer currently in San Diego, but he's coming to Diverse Works from between March 13th and 23rd. And all of that and more, let's go to This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 1st, 2003. New Mexico is on its way to becoming the 14th U.S. state to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, as both the House and Senate passed separate bills this week. Democratic Governor Bill Richardson has promised to sign into law a final version once both the House and Senate have passed the same bill. First, about 60% of the House approved a bill introduced by Democratic representative from Albuquerque, Gail Beam, and then 53% of the Senate approved a bill introduced by Democratic senator from Albuquerque, Cisco McSorley. Both bills would amend the state's existing Human Rights Act to protect lesbian gays from discrimination in employment, housing, credit, public accommodations, and union membership. Now, supporters, led by the Coalition for Equality in New Mexico, are hoping to get the House to pass the Senate version of the bill. The House debated for only an hour before approving its bill, even though it's rejected all similar bills beginning in 1991. Senators spent 5 hours in an emotional tussle between supportive Democrats and opposing Republicans.
That struggle between the parties then continued another 3 hours before more than 58% of the senators went on to pass a gay and trans-inclusive hate crimes bill the following day. That bill, introduced by Democrat from Las Cruces, Mary Jane Garcia, will next go to the House. New Mexico is currently one of only a handful of states with no law expanding penalties for any form of bias crime. Its last governor, Republican Gary Johnson, vetoed two of them.
Illinois activists who've been lobbying for civil rights protections for almost 30 years are also hoping to win enactment now that Democrats control both houses of their state legislature. Their hopes were fired this week when the state Senate Executive Committee, which the group Equality Illinois calls the most conservative committee in the Illinois Senate, for the first time ever approved a bill to add sexual orientation and gender identity to the state's Human Rights Act. That law covers employment, housing, credit, and public accommodations. It was strictly a party-line vote, with 8 Democrats supporting and 5 Republicans opposing the bill, introduced by Democratic Senator from Edgewater, Carol Ronan. The bill will move next to the Senate floor, where its success is by no means assured. Democratic Governor Rob Blagojevich has been a vocal supporter.
But civil rights bills have failed in Nebraska and Hawaii. Gay supportive Nebraska State Senator from Omaha, Ernie Chambers, last week reintroduced a bill to prohibit employment discrimination based on sexual orientation, only to see it rejected immediately in committee. Chambers plans to try again this legislative session, vowing to do whatever it takes to win passage.
Hawaii bills in both the state House and Senate to add sexual orientation to the state's law against discrimination in housing and real estate transactions fell victim to a legislative deadline this week. Another Hawaii bill to add gender identity or expression to the victim categories in the state's hate crimes law passed a Senate committee this week and moves next to the Senate floor.
And remarkably, the Utah State House of Representatives this week narrowly passed a hate crimes bill, including sexual orientation among its victim categories. The margin of success was just 3 votes, and the very next day, a move to reconsider the same bill succeeded by a single vote. For 6 years, similar bills have failed in a state legislature which has enacted specifically anti-gay laws. And surprisingly, the powerful Utah-based Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as the Mormons, broke with its long history of combating gay-friendly legislation to actually issue a formal statement that it did not oppose the bill introduced by Democratic representative from Salt Lake City, David Litvak. The statement said, "The church abhors all hate crimes. The church's well-known opposition to attempts to legalize same-gender marriage should never be interpreted as justification for hatred, intolerance, or abuse of those who profess homosexual tendencies, either individually or as a group." A church-owned radio station, television station, and newspaper went even farther, editorializing for prompt passage.
In California, suspects entered guilty pleas this week in 2 notorious murder cases that are emblematic of hate crimes against gays and transgenders. One of the 4 suspects charged with the grisly October murder of young Newark trans woman Gwen Araujo has struck a deal with prosecutors. Jaron Nabors pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter this week and will be sentenced to 11 years imprisonment in exchange for testifying against his friends, the other 3 suspects, in their murder trial. It was Nabors who led police to the body of Araujo, who was 17 when she was beaten, bound, strangled, and buried in the Sierra foothills after the men who had engaged in sex with her learned that she had male genitals. Araujo's death was marked by a number of demonstrations and created a new level of awareness of transgender issues in her conservative San Francisco Bay Area.
Tyler Williams admitted to shooting gay couple Gary Mattson and Winfield Mauder in 1999 as they slept in their home in Happy Valley. In return for pleading guilty, Williams will be sentenced to 25 years to life rather than facing a possible death penalty. White supremacist Williams was joined in that slaying, as well as in the massive firebombings of 3 synagogues, by his brother Matthew Williams, but Matthew killed himself while in jail. Victims Mattson and Mauder were well-known and well-liked in their rural Northern California community, and their deaths sparked active organizing against hate violence in the Redding area.
Domestic partners of Iowa's state employees, including same-gender partners, are set to receive spousal health and dental coverage for the first time in July. That's part of the union contract the state ratified this week with the state's branch of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. The Iowa legislature can't change the contract terms, although it may not approve full funding for the plan when it comes up later this year. The ratification was made public on the same day that an Iowa Senate committee considered a bill to specifically prohibit gays and lesbians from serving as adoptive or foster parents. No vote was taken, and it's not clear if one will be scheduled before the end of the legislative session.
Back in Illinois, Tom Tunney became the first open gay to be elected to Chicago's Board of Aldermen, winning 59% of the 44th ward vote this week against 4 challengers. Tunney had become Chicago's first openly gay city councilor when he was appointed by Mayor Richard Daley to fill a vacancy in January.
Last week, openly gay president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Tom Amiano, announced he'll be running for mayor of San Francisco in November. Longtime gay-friendly Mayor Willie Brown, whom Amiano forced into a runoff in 1999 with just a write-in campaign, won't be running again because of term limits, but at least 8 others will, including openly lesbian city treasurer Susan Leal.
A more surprising declaration of candidacy came this week in Tokyo, where trans woman Aya Kamikawa is running as an independent for a seat in the Setagaya Ward Assembly. Her campaign is in large part an effort to raise public awareness of the status of transsexuals in Japan who cannot legally alter their official registration to show their post-surgical gender.
And there's another openly gay member of parliament in Britain after Clive Betts publicly came out this week in an exclusive interview with the tabloid The Star. Betts, a former Labour Party whip who has been representing Sheffield Attercliffe for more than a decade, has a gay-supportive voting record, and his sexual orientation was already known to many of his friends and colleagues. But after Bett's announcement, the tabloid Sun printed a luridly detailed front-page story that some activists labeled homophobic and which led a number of MPs to criticize the press for intruding on his privacy. Bett had applied for a House of Commons pass for his boyfriend, Jose Gasparo, a young Brazilian he had hired as a research assistant. The Sun reported that Gasparo's photo appears on the website of a gay escort service and said Betts had hired him through the service. Betts' version is that he met Gasparo socially and learned later on that he had previously worked as an escort. Betts also said he'd terminated Gasparo's research job when they became close. Metropolitan Police routinely perform security checks on applicants for Commons passes, but reportedly MI5 is investigating Gasparo as well because of the security risk presented by his foreign citizenship. In the wake of the controversy, Betts dropped the application for Gasparo's pass.
And finally, Decision, despite the recent name change and its recanting, despite the lack of the accustomed live TV coverage, and despite a high terror alert forcing intensive security measures, the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras held its 25th annual march this weekend before hundreds of thousands of cheering spectators. While Mardi Gras organizers continue to pursue serious political goals of equality legislation in the state of New South Wales, the glitz and fun stole the spotlight. Openly gay rugby star Coombe actor Ian Roberts led off the march with the traditional Dykes on Bikes and their less traditional gay male counterparts. Even with a much smaller budget than recent years' parades, there were 5,000 to 6,000 marchers and 140 floats. A group of Virginia Woolf impersonators with outrageous fake noses poked fun at Nicole Kidman's performance in the film The Hours. And a colorful mock tank surrounded by mustachioed dancers was entitled Madame Saddam and Her Weapons of Mass Seduction.
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 1st, 2003. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
This is Queer Voices.
And it's time for our usual monthly segment with David Elliott. David Elliott is calling us from Washington. Are you there, David?
I am indeed on the line, Jack. Good evening to you.
Before we start off, I know you wanted to talk about the peace movement in our community, and I sent you an article. I don't know if you got a chance to read it, but Sheila Jackson Lee was attending a rally this weekend, which was pro-war rally.
Yeah, the Rally for America, it was called.
And she got pretty much booed off the stage.
I did indeed see that article. And, you know, it told me a couple of things. It told me that despite the fact that here in Washington and New York City and San Francisco and Portland and Berkeley and all over the U.S., there have been a number of demonstrations against the war, there are also demonstrations for the war, and emotions on this issue are running very, very, very high.
Well, where does our community stand on this?
Well, you know, Jack, ABC News tonight is reporting that the U.S. may launch an attack on Iraq toward the end of next week. That's just inside 14 days from now. And the truth of the matter is that special operations forces already are operating inside Iraq, and the number of bombing raids that the U.S. is launching is on the increase. And as was the case during the Gulf War of 1991, the nation's leading LGBT groups are divided over, A, whether U.S. military action is justified, and B, over this, whether this is an issue that the LGBT community should be speaking out on. Now, the very first groups to come out against the war in Iraq were the National Center for Lesbian Rights, the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, the National Youth Advocacy Coalition, NIAC for short, and the Mottner Project for Lesbians with Cancer. Debate over the war reached a head at the Creating Change Conference in Portland last November. As you know, this conference is an annual conference, and it's hosted by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Critics pointed out that even though NGLTF hosted several forums on the war, it had yet to take a stance at the time of Creating Change. At that time, the organization's executive director, Lori Jean, said, quote, "The task force has not taken a formal stance on Iraq. There is another war that greatly concerns me, and that is the war on freedom in this country, the war on civil liberties, close quote. Now, later, in fact, in late December, NGLTF did announce that it was joining a broad coalition of groups opposed to the war. And then NGLTF, and I have to, you know, disclose right now the fact that I used to be their communications person.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want the audience to know that. NGLTF then found itself being criticized by folks like Chris Crane, who serves as editor and publisher of the Washington Blade, which, you know, owns the Houston Voice and also the Southern Voice in Atlanta and the New York Blade. And Crane asks why NGLTF and other LGBT groups are, quote-unquote, wasting time with the war on Iraq. He writes this, and I'm quoting here. I'm reading you quoted material. These aren't my own words. These are Chris's words. Quote, are they so flush with success, having achieved victory in the battle for gay civil rights, that they can divert their activism to weigh in on foreign policy matters that bear no connection to our movement? Are their coffers so awash in contributions that they can afford to expend time, energy, and resources to fight a complex international concern in which they begin and end with absolutely no hope of making any appreciable difference? Do they already enjoy such access and influence in the new Washington of GOP dominance that they can risk the political capital and street credibility they lose by jumping on the peacenik bandwagon, however far afield the issue may be from the cause of gay rights? The answers to all of these questions, Crane writes, is of course no. He says that the grown coalition of gay groups against the war cannot be explained by anything other than lockstep, knee-jerking by the activists currently in charge at each of these organizations. Now, thankfully, there are other voices in our community. In response to Chris's editorial, lesbian columnist Paula Martinik, who might be my favorite columnist in the United States, except, of course, for Joan, urged both LGBT organizations and the LGBT media to speak out against the war. She writes, and I quote, queer organizations and publications are finally breaking their silence about war with Iraq, coming out either for or against aggression. Indeed, many of us recognize that the gay movement can no longer avoid speaking publicly on this important issue, which affects us so directly. At the same time, however, some right-wing gay writers still seem to believe that debate, and in particular dissent, about war is inappropriate. Now, finally, I'd like to close by quoting longtime lesbian rights activist Mandy Carter, a hero of mine, who was among the speakers at the last Creating Change conference. Carter said, quote, as an out black lesbian peace and justice activist, I don't limit my activism to, quote, gay only, close quote, issues. Our LGBT movement shouldn't do so either. Issues about militarism are very relevant. The same U.S. government that unilaterally engages in wars in other countries is the exact same government that wants to deny basic civil rights to people in this country based on race, class, gender, and sexual orientation. So that's the debate in our community. Emotions are running very high. It looks like we're about to go to war, and gay and lesbian activists and the activist groups are going to have to decide what to do and what to say about it.
Well, and there are a number of issues. I mean, certainly, you know, I mean, the argument there is that we haven't been so successful in what our primary purpose is in our organizations to be doing. But at the same time, and I was lucky enough to be able to speak at the Radical Encampment Conference here in Houston a weekend ago, you know, by going to war, we're totally forgetting about what's going on in our backyard. I mean, it's sort of an excuse to, you know, to underfund almost everything that's going on. You look at almost every state budget in this country, and they're in the red. Most of the cities, I mean, Houston's facing a $59 million deficit, and these states and cities most times cannot have deficit spending. And that money is not coming back to us. It's going to all this other stuff. And, you know, even the supposed term of Homeland Security, there's no funding for that.
Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, look at the state of Texas.
$10 billion.
In the current budget proposal that's before the Texas legislature, 140,000 children, low-income children, would lose access to health care. Texas would, in effect, eliminate Medicaid as we know it, because the state wouldn't be coughing up the matching funds that would make healthcare providers allow people to opt in to Medicaid programs. And, you know, those are only two examples. I know that across the United States, and, you know, we talked about this a month ago, Jack, across the United States, people are having their AIDS medications taken away.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's incredible. And it's also true that even though, while our community has made some legislative advances, you know, in the current legislative sessions, you know, look what's about to happen in New Mexico, for instance. They're probably going to enact a civil rights law. It's also true that the concept of civil rights is never a friend with the concept of war. Whatever civil rights issue you look at, whether it's LGBT civil rights, whether it's freedom of expression, First Amendment issues, whether it's the issue that I currently work on, the death penalty, in the long run, these issues never fare well, never do very well when we're in crisis, when we're at war. And so, yeah, you got to step back and you got to look at the larger picture.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, what's happening in this country? I mean, everything is just going down the drain. Everything that we fought for the past 40 years seems to be either publicly we're finding out about, or behind us we're finding out that has been just cut back or just completely being done away with.
These are bleak times, but spring is on the way. Unfortunately, you know, and I use that as a metaphor. You know, we know literally that spring is on the way, although Washington, D.C. right now is in the mid-20s with the wind chill factor in the teens, and we've gotten 40 inches of snow this year, and everybody's sick of it.
Well, and it's only 49 degrees here, too, so.
I'd take 49 degrees in a minute, folks. But seriously, it's going to, politically speaking, it's going to take a little bit longer for spring to get here. People in Washington right now, and I know, you know, I have to recognize that probably folks in Houston aren't talking about this a whole lot, but people in Washington are just absolutely scrutinizing all of the Democratic presidential wannabes right now. And, you know, we now have something like 8 or 9 announced candidates. I can hardly keep track of all the announced candidates, and I'm a political junkie.
Right.
So we'll have our day at Election Day. You know, the sad thing is it'll probably come a little bit too late for a lot of civilians in Iraq and you know, all of the people who were displaced when wars happen, you know, either because their houses are bombed, or, you know, that their food and water supplies are cut off, or because there's an outbreak of disease. It's going to be a little too late for them, I fear.
Well, in no two ways about it. What's going on over there is absolutely terrible. People have been, you know, gassed by their own government, starved by their own government. But, you know, who are we to be playing God?
Who are we to be the moral enforcers? I agree, and I'm kind of conservative on this issue, but I agree that the international community must find a way to force Saddam Hussein to go. But who says that the U.S. has to lead that effort? Why can't Finland lead the effort for a change?
Right, and maybe do it right. I mean, look at how many times we've tried to do this and completely screwed up.
Yeah, I mean, we supported Saddam when he came to power. We gave him some of his chemical weapons.
Absolutely. So, what else is going on in Washington?
Well, you know, that's enough for one month.
Yes.
Seriously, though, you know, you look at a legislation that's moving or not moving in Congress, you know, that affects our community, and the truth is, you know, there are always important issues involving judicial nominations and budgetary issues, but everything is going to be taking a back seat to Iraq or the next terror attack, or, you know, that's really what's going on right now. That's, you know, it's a rather limited news cycle.
Okay. Well, David, thank you for joining us, and you can reach David through www.ncadp.org. David joins us every week from Washington.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I'd like to say hello to everyone who's listening to Queer Voices tonight. Y'all keep up the good work.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
The myriad Middle East crises clearly have political ramifications around the world, and it's not news that the issues create rifts even among progressive activists. Quit, Queers Undermining Israeli Terrorism, is engaged in an effort to support the Palestinian cause by getting U.S. businesses and governments to divest their financial interests in Israel. Members of Quit took part in a controversial boycott of Rainbow, a collectively owned San Francisco grocery store, over whether the store should sell Israeli-made products. That action brought out demonstrators on both sides of the issue. Mindy Spat, Jack Tilney, and Deej Gold discuss Quit's pro-Palestinian perspective.
So, what is this boycott all about?
Well, it's part of a larger effort going on throughout this country and internationally to stop various stores from selling Israeli goods because the money that is paid for export taxes on those goods is being used basically to shoot innocent Palestinian people, to deprive them of their homes and livelihoods.
Is this part of the divestment campaign?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is. And that campaign is one that has been very strong here in the Bay Area. Activists have been lobbying the Berkeley City Council to divest from Israel, and there have been some movements, I believe, on the UC Berkeley campus as well. This is our way of saying, especially to our local institutions, Rainbow is a collective grocery store here that's been involved in many political struggles over the years, and we from Quit felt that as a part of the community that we could approach them and ask them to support Palestinian rights, which means not carrying Israeli products.
So are there other groups involved in this boycott?
Yeah, a number of groups have been involved in the divestment campaign as a whole, both general peace organizations, organizations within Israel itself have been beginning to call for a boycott of goods. Just a month or two ago, a number of academics within Israel has been calling for a boycott of academic institutions until the occupation ends. And within the United States, there have been peace groups, feminist groups, groups from different communities, the African American community, the Latino community, et cetera, who have been supporting divestment from Israel. That divestment includes not doing business with Israel until they end their occupation, which is illegal under international law of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The right of return for refugees, which is also part of international law under the United Nations Resolution 194, as well as the UN Charter. And finally, an end to the apartheid nature of the State of Israel. We call it an apartheid state because Israel has a number of laws which privileges one group of people, Jews, over non-Jews under Israeli law. This involves, for example, not allowing non-Jews to own or lease land. Over 90% of the land within the 1967 borders of Israel cannot be owned or leased by non-Jews, even though the Palestinian minority within Israel makes up 20% of the population. Within the occupied territories itself, the Palestinian population there has absolutely no rights and are subject to Israeli military orders exclusively. Their land can be confiscated at will for the construction of settlements, again illegal, for the construction of bypass roads, which can be used by Israeli Jews only, for the uprooting of all crops and the destruction of agricultural land. And so we've been protesting our government's support of Israel through the divestment campaign.
Isn't it anti-Semitic to oppose Israel?
Well, that's an argument that's certainly used to attack the pro-Palestinian movement a lot, and one that I, as a Jewish lesbian, am particularly sensitive to. Many of us in Quit are Jewish, and many people in the peace movement are Jewish. There's a large peace movement in Israel. I guess the question is, which part of Israel do we here in the United States identify with? Do we identify with a repressive and violent government, or do we identify with the forces that are pushing for peace? As queers, we very much want to identify with the Israeli peace movement. We want to encourage others in our community to identify with and support those Israeli queers who are also fighting for peace in the region.
So what else has Quit been doing?
Quit's participated in a number of actions around the Israel-Palestinian conflict, as well as around the Middle East in general. We'll be mobilizing against the impending war in Iraq. We've also held demonstrations in solidarity with gays in Egypt who had been arbitrarily imprisoned within the last year or so, and their trials are continuing.
What about the claim that Israel is the only true democracy in the Middle East and that Israel has granted rights to gay people?
That's very well true. Israel may have more democratic rights, certainly, than other states in the Middle East, but that also has to be looked at the context of what we were just talking about, the apartheid nature of the state. South Africa, during its apartheid rule, could be considered a democracy in the sense that all white South Africans certainly had rights, as you could certainly say the same thing about the United States during prior to the Civil Rights Movement, where it was called a democracy, even though people were African-Americans and other minorities fell under rules of separate but equal and outright apartheid and discrimination in housing and education and all kinds of things. Modern Israel is continuing policies which both the United States and South Africa discarded long ago and which the international community has rejected as oppressive and certainly unworthy of any state which wishes to call itself a democracy.
But isn't Israel a better place for queers?
Well, I suppose it is for Jewish queers, but certainly not for Palestinian queers. It's not as if being queer would prevent you from being treated the way other Palestinians are, from being stopped at checkpoints, from being prevented to work. It's not as if you'd be allowed to have a passport, which most Palestinians don't have. I mean, I think it's really important that we in the gay community not have tunnel vision and not see all issues through a narrow frame of how does it affect us as gay people. I mean, we're living on this earth with everyone else, and I think what we want to see is freedom for everybody.
Those were San Francisco activists Mindy Spat, Jack Tilney, and Dej Gold of Quit, Queers Undermining Israeli Terrorism.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, it's that time of year again. It's time for the AIDS Walk, and hopefully the weather is going to be perfect this Sunday. We'll see if we can get all of our gay weathermen out there to make that happen. We have a guest here tonight to talk about it. Will you introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Anissa Hill, and I'm program coordinator with the AIDS Foundation of Houston.
Okay, and what is this event all about?
This event is to raise awareness and funds for ourselves, along with 10 other AIDS and HIV agencies within the Houston area.
Okay, and being that the AIDS Foundation has grown so much over the years, it does take a lot of money to keep it going, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And is this, I mean, there is some government support, of course, that keeps some of the programs going, but there's an awful lot of other things that is required for the AIDS Foundation. What are some of the services that the AIDS Foundation provides?
We provide many different services, including residential sites for women, children, and men as well. We also provide pediatrics programs. We provide resources for a food pantry to provide food for clients. Also client services with a wide range of different services.
Well, you know, in the early days, when it was actually called the KS AIDS Foundation, right?
In the
beginning, pretty much it was 6 months and people were gone. They passed away. And now people are living longer, which is good, but it also means that they require services. Some people I understand who become HIV positive can live semi-normal life, you know, with or without the drugs, depending on all that. But once you start getting sick, it does take some help.
Absolutely. Even those who are not sick, of course, with the medical today, we are finding that people can live a full life. And, you know, thank God, that's wonderful. But, of course, with a wide range of them, living longer provides more people for us to provide services for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from hospital visitations to everything. And it does. It costs a lot of money to keep us going. Volunteers is the main reason why we're up and running. So it's really important to raise the money to keep these programs going.
And what is like the food assistance that you have, Stone Soup?
Yes.
What exactly is that?
It's a food pantry based on donations. And our clients are able to come to the food pantry 3 times a month and shop, just like a small grocery store. If a client is homeward bound and too sick to leave, we also have a program in which brings groceries to them. So a lot of clients, whether they have limited funds, whether they're unable to work, whether their food stamps only last so long, they're able to provide food beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And as we originally saw, that most of the people affected by this directly was gay men. And that, of course, has changed a lot, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. We're finding now that the largest population being infected is of Latino and African-American descent. And it's greatly increasing in that population. What we're also finding is that the younger generation of gay men are being affected. I think because they did not see the devastation that we once saw with HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, seeing people living full lives. So we're also seeing an increase in young gay men.
Yeah, and sometimes you see the ads in the paper with all these drugs that it just looks like you can go out and climb mountains and do all these wonderful things. And as one person told me, you know, they don't see you, you know, 10 minutes later when you're puking. And, you know, the drugs are wonderful things, but they're all, drugs are poison. And they help keep you alive, but they do have side effects.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have a game that we give our volunteers in which we give them M&Ms. Mm-hmm. And they have to follow a regimen of the M&Ms. You know, take the red ones 1 hour before food, the green ones 2 hours after food, some with milk, some with an empty stomach. They haven't had a volunteer yet be able to follow it. And that's just one of the... Right. Basic regimens of HIV medications.
That's right, because I think a lot of people are under the mistaken impression that if they're diagnosed with it, it's like birth control. You give them a little set of pills and they take one a day and that's it.
Absolutely. And it's a difficult thing to follow.
It's kind of a job in itself,
it
actually.
It really is. It really is. And to be, of course, that's something you want to kind of keep private. You know,
right.
and to be in a meeting and have to leave the office to go take your meds at a particular time can be very difficult.
Well, the reality is a lot of people have to be very secretive about it because if they lose their job or they move to another job, they could be blacklisted in a sense that if they're HIV, that, you know, they won't get hired.
Absolutely, and unfortunate.
Yeah, unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And if you're outside the system, there's no private health insurer that will insure you.
Absolutely right.
And there is a state system, but it's incredibly expensive.
Yes, and in fact, we are finding that just recently they have decreased the income limit for the drug assistance programs, which is cutting out millions of Texans in the Houston area also.
Right, and it was sort of a double, whatever you want to call that. The fact is that if they're on, you know, they're just barely making it, and if they have to pay for the drugs, they have a choice of either, you know, living, getting the drugs, or living.
Absolutely.
And it's really, really sad, because in the end, it ends up costing the system more.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about the walk. I know it's a fun event. What is the walk? Exactly, what do you do?
The walk is an absolutely fun event. It is one of our single largest fundraiser. And like I said, it doesn't just benefit our agency. It benefits over 10 agencies within the Houston area. It is a walk 3.5 miles down at the Sam Houston Park. Leading off of Bagby. We'll also have a fun area. We'll have food. We'll have a little play area for the children to be in. All types of fun things to do. It's a great event. It's a great event for people to get together, show their support. A lot of teams come out and wear matching t-shirts, and it's a great way to maybe bring business people together, bring your family out to show support. It's a wonderful event and really brings a lot of camaraderie with people.
Well, and we're not a commercial station, but certainly we can mention that JP Morgan Chase has been in part for a number of years, haven't they, of the walk?
Yes, they are a huge and continual supporter.
And, in fact, their Pride team, which is also marches in the parade, majority of those people in the Pride team are not GLPT people. They're
right.
Friends or stuff. So Sam Houston Park is basically on the western edge of downtown near the Allen Parkway Memorial area.
Yes.
What time?
Well, registration starts at 8 a.m. The walk will
begin.
Do you
have to be registered?
No, you can actually register the day of. Absolutely.
Yes, and we know GLBD people wait till the last minute.
I was going to say.
Absolutely.
You kind of have to have that. That's a little bit mandatory.
Absolutely. I know for sure. Yes, you can register that day of. We have, at any of the Starbucks, we have walks out and brochures. You can register the day of, or you can give us a call, or you can get online, www.aidswalkhouston.org, and you can do everything there.
Okay. And it's at 8 a.m. this Sunday. And how long does it go?
We will be done by noon.
Okay. And how many people do you expect? Of course, it depends on the weather, I know.
Absolutely. You know, we're expecting probably a few hundred at least. The more, the merrier.
Okay. And if somebody wants to get in touch with the AIDS Foundation and find out more about your services, how can they do that?
They can do that by either calling us at 713-623-6796, or you can also get online, www.aidshelp.org.
And if you missed any of that, you can go to our website, queervoices.org, and we have a link to the AIDS Foundation for this week's show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Don't look now, it's got nothing to do with you. Don't look now, you're not one of the chosen few. He made his bed, now he's got to lie in it. That was all you said about the life he led. If they could only find a cure. Friends of mine like Jim, I'll never see the likes of him. Don't look now, it's got nothing to do with you. Don't look now, you're not one. One of these days was one day too late for him. If they could only find a cure. Friends of mine like them, I'll never see the likes of him. If they could only find not your friends of mine like Jim. I'll never see the likes of him.
From 1993, the album Harmony Hotel. That was the Williams Brothers, Don't Look Now. This is Queer Voices.
Over 10 years ago, author Eric Marcus published Making History, the story of the gay rights movement as told by the people who were there. In a new and improved edition, renamed Making Gay History, Marcus revises and expands the story of GLBT lives from the early 1950s to post-9/11. This layout's Steve Pride talked with Marcus about his updated queer chronicle.
History never looks like history when you're living through it. Events today may be pivotal in the chronicles that are written tomorrow, but one thing is certain. Anything we do now is constructed on the foundation laid down by the gay men and lesbians who came before us. Author Eric Marcus chronicles their stories and the stories of a movement in his book, Making Gay History, The Half-Century Fight for Lesbian and Gay Equal Rights.
I'm Eric Marcus. The book came about when an editor at HarperCollins called me and asked if I would write a history of the gay rights movement, an oral history. I faced an enormous challenge when I started researching this book because there were so many people to choose from. My criteria was simple. The story had to be interesting. The person I was interviewing had to be able to tell a story. An oral history is storytelling, essentially. And I was more interested in talking to people who hadn't been talked to many times before. People who've been interviewed over and over again tend to tell the same story every time, and the story sometimes grows more elaborate over time. And when you ask two people to tell the same story, you get many different perspectives. And what was fun was asking people about the same events and hearing the different perspectives. So for example, when I talk in the book about the Stonewall Riot, or at least when the people I interviewed talk about the Stonewall Riot, there are four or five people who meet at that point in the book, who you've met at earlier places in the book, and you get to hear about Stonewall from different perspectives. So my hope is that through the stories of these different people, we get a truer look at what actually happened at Stonewall.
For every person, there is a point of view, and one challenge faced by author Eric Marcus was separating fact from legend. As Napoleon once said, history is only the version of past events that people have decided to agree upon.
For example, Ray Sylvia Rivera, a drag queen who was there at the time, who might be called a transgendered person today or a transvestite, but he called himself a drag queen. The popular account of Stonewall is that a bunch of drag queens fought back against police repression on the night of June 27th, 1969. There was a riot, and out of that riot grew the gay rights movement. Ray was quick to point out that the Stonewall was not the drag queen bar. That was the Washington Square bar, which was somewhere else, and that there were very few drag queens at Stonewall the night of the riot. When I started working on this book, I assumed the gay rights movement began in 1969 and was shocked to learn. In fact, the gay rights movement began, obviously, years before, in 1950. And following the riot, there was a meeting called by the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis. The Mattachine Society of New York dates back to Los Angeles in 1950. The Daughters of Bilitis dates back to 1955 in San Francisco. So it was out of these two organizations that the new gay rights movement was born. But it couldn't have been born, or at least it couldn't have progressed in the way it did, with founding of the Gay Liberation Front, an organization that spread across the country like Queer Nation did in the late 80s and early 90s. The movement could not have developed in that way if there hadn't been a pretty solid foundation created by these earlier organizations. So the myth of this single event leading to a movement is really a myth. And the story that it was led by drag queens who were indeed participants in this riot, but that it was led by and that it was all drag queens is also a myth, which is not to discount the role of men who dressed as women or women who were butch or any of the other people who were involved. This is what happened, and it's important to know what happened, because the myth is not nearly as interesting or as rich as the story of what actually happened at Stonewall that night and in the nights that followed in June of 1969.
According to Eric Marcus, today we often gloss over the difficulties post-Stonewall, pre-AIDS. It was a time when the differences between gay men and lesbians sometimes overshadowed the shared battle.
There has been infighting in the gay rights movement ever since the beginning. Men who thought that the effeminate men shouldn't be allowed in, or the effeminate men who thought that the butch men were just putting on an act, between the men and women, the women who were very upset with the men for, as one woman put it, their bathroom habits, because the men were getting arrested in the bathrooms having sex with each other. There was never a moment when this was a movement that was cohesive and without difficulties, without argument. This is an incredibly diverse movement, and I think one of the strengths of it is that it is diverse. Today, there are organizations that satisfy almost everyone. I hear complaints from people saying, the Human Rights Campaign does not represent my views. Why do they speak for the gay community? Well, the Human Rights Campaign speaks for a large segment of the gay and lesbian population in America. They speak for their constituents, for their members. If you're not happy with HRC, join Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, or your local chapter of GLSEN, or PFLAG, or Gay Men's Leather Group, or whatever it is you're interested in, you can find today. But there's no one group that will speak for all of us, and there's no one group that should. I see that as a strength. The conflict is natural. We come from such diverse backgrounds. Why would we all think in one way? I remember in the 1970s when San Francisco's Castro Street was at its peak, all gay men had to wear, or they were supposed to wear, at least I got, those are the instructions I got in the mail, Lacoste shirts, not Lacoste shirts, then flannel shirts, jeans, preferably tight, work boots. You had to have a mustache, and men who had brown hair and chest hair were most esteemed. Now you can't have any body hair, and you should have blonde hair and be blue-eyed, and young, preferably. It's not nearly as rigid now as it was then. We're a happily diverse group, and anyone who expresses displeasure or disappointment needs to look at the history to see that we have thrived in our diversity, and that will never change.
Marcus spoke with over 100 people, and 63 interviews are included in the book.
I wish I could have talked to more people, but sometimes you could get things confirmed in other ways. Frank Kameny, who was the founder of Washington Mattachine in 1961, gave an account of what happened, how the organization came to be. I was able to look at the FBI records, because there were FBI agents who showed up at these meetings and who kept records. Randy Schiltz, the late famous journalist who wrote And the Band Played On, lent me his FBI files, so I was able to read about the accounts from the perspective of the FBI. And everything that Frank Kameny said was confirmed by the FBI files. And when that happened, it was so exciting. Or when somebody I was interviewing would talk about something that somebody else had talked about and confirmed what I had heard. Those were often serendipitous crossings of history where people came together. So I didn't set out to have the stories interlink, but almost magically, people's lives crossed paths in the course of this book.
It's a cliche that those who ignore history are bound to repeat it. It is also true. But before we can learn from gay and lesbian history, we must just learn.
I think this is a subject that should be taught, that should be introduced to young people, just as we teach about the Black Civil Rights Movement, as we talk about the women's movement in history classes. It's still not easy to be a gay and lesbian person in America today. And I think it's very important for all gay and lesbian people to know about this history because they can draw inspiration from it.
For more information on Making Gay History or other books by Eric Marcus, point your internet browser to www.ericmarcus.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Barney Frank, AIDS, Quilt, Act Up, Randy Schiltz, Queer Nation, Mapplethor, Phase ET, Amendment 2, Cracker Barrel, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, HX, Cyber Sex, March on DC, Greg Louganis, Selton, John George Michael, what is going on? Lilith Fair, Rowdy Girls, Spend a Day at Disney World, Kunan and Scare them, Nick the Kiss, Ian Allen, Will and Grace, Matthew Shepard, God bless you, what else can we look forward to? Pride, pride, gotta have pride. We've been around too long to keep it inside. Pride, can't sit back and watch from the side. Pride is power and power is pride.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Rex Wagner, Chris Ambage, and Steve Pride contributed program material. John Gilbert Levitt performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thank you for listening on 2TLC Yamba, New South Wales, 4NAG Yeppoon, Queensland, 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, and more than 135 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky, Joan Devlin, and Glenn Holt.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're
good evening. You're listening to Queer Voices. I have Ken Jones in the studio with me. And Ken, you're going to be wearing a couple of different hats here for this interview. You are the president of the Houston Lesbian and Gay Political Caucus, and you've had that position now for a little bit over a year.
About 16 months.
And you're going to be doing something special for Lobby Day along with PFLAG.
That's great. We are chartering two buses. The first bus will leave on Sunday, March 16th. Actually, both buses will leave on Sunday, March 16th, early that morning. It'll be on Sunday morning. Go up and be in Austin for the rally in front of the state capitol, hopefully to stop some of these hateful legislative things that are coming down. And one bus will come back after that is over and be back on Sunday, early Sunday evening, we think. The second bus, the people on that bus will stay over and actually lobby their legislators the next day.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, I think it's really important. We really want a good group of people to come out and do that. And we're working on negotiating a hotel at this time. Mm-hmm. And we think we're going to be able to do it for a pretty reasonable price. We especially want people that are in Republican districts mm-hmm. to come out and lobby some of our Republicans in the legislature. It's really important that we have some Republicans listen to our concerns and hopefully vote our way. And the only way they're going to vote our way is if they realize they've got some constituents that mm-hmm. will vote their concerns when it comes to the ballot box. So we need help.
Great. Now, this is a very important Lobby Day. I mean, they're all important, but this one is extremely important because there's been a bit of a proliferation of anti-gay bills coming up this last session.
Yes. Unfortunately, there are three, and there's rumored to be four, bills out. One will prevent gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender persons from serving as foster parents. A second bill would prevent gay and lesbian adoption of children. And then, of course, the ubiquitous Defense of Marriage Act that's mm-hmm. been hanging around and trying to rear its ugly head every 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just need to make sure our legislators know that we want them to listen to us and
right.
and hopefully stop these things and keep them out of the actual voting process. If we can them in a committee, it's much easier to stop them. If they actually make it to the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate, they're much harder to stop because a lot of legislators are scared because those votes are usually those votes are counted.
Right.
Whereas the votes in committee are usually just by a show of hands. And so, you know, someone who may vote our way if they don't have to go on record for
right.
it. But when they have to go on record, they're a little less brave.
Right. And the other thing, too, with this particular session of the legislature, we've lost some good friends. We've lost Deborah Danborough. We've lost some other people. If this thing comes out of committee, we're going to have a uphill struggle, I would think, to get this to be voted down.
We have to keep it in committee. We have to bottle it up in committee. There are a lot of legislators that when it comes down to brass tacks, if it's a record vote, they're going to vote against us.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that time and time again.
Yeah. It's a shame, but that's the way it is.
Anyway, but these buses will be a lot of fun. We're going to have, be a group of gay and gay-friendly people, PFLAG people, on the buses with us. And we'll be discussing how to lobby your legislator. Just because you've never done it before doesn't mean you can't do it.
Right.
The caucus meeting this Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the Community Center, which is moved, of course, to 3400 Montrose, we're going to have a class on how to lobby your legislator. And then also on Monday morning, prior to the actual going around and meeting the different legislators, lesbian and gay Texas lobby group,
LGRL,
is going to have a class also. And we're probably going to also make some signs on Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're good with artwork, we'd love to have some help. We want to make some fun signs.
Oh, what? That is good. There's always some good signs at these lobby days.
I got a good laugh recently on the internet, you know, reading signs that were seen at one of the anti-war lobby.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, that was good. Fire bureaucrats, not missiles. Yes.
It's nuclear, not nuclear.
Oh, God.
But,
and speaking of that, speaking of people who can't speak, George Bush, why don't we talk a little bit? Because, you know, last week people were disappointed by the first publicized trial results of the AIDS vaccine. It did prove to be disappointing. It showed some improvement in African American and Asian populations, but also there was such a small sampling of the test group that those results themselves were not particularly conclusive. And as we talked about that, you told me about some statistics that were being suppressed.
It's really, I hope I don't bore you here, and please hang with me. I'm a retired physician, and there are some things that have happened recent that I think we need to understand the importance. You know, just 2 years ago when we had our census, in that census was a question, you know, is this person that's not married to you in this household who is also an adult, do you consider them your significant partner? I can't remember the exact words of it. We all thought that was great because it gave an opportunity for us to find out if there were gay and lesbian households. Those things don't just happen out of the blue. There's a lot of lobbying by our organizations that get those changes into effect. I can assure you the right wing hated that census.
Uh-huh.
They did not like us being out there. They would prefer that we be in the closet. They don't want to know about us. They don't want uh-huh. their children to know about us. They want us to be hidden. In 1998, the Institute of Medicine, which is a quasi-governmental group, came out with a statement, and this required a lot of lobbying by the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association to get them to do this. But they said, we don't know many of the questions that we should be asking about gay and lesbian health. We don't have any data about gay and lesbian health. We don't know what questions we need to be asking about it. In other words, just think about it. What percentage of lesbians smoke? What percentage of gay men smoke? We don't know because we've never asked that question. Now, If you go into Chance's bar, you think 98% of lesbians smoke.
Right.
But you go into other bars and you think it's, oh, you know, 28, 35%, something like that. We don't know the answers to those questions. Okay, breast cancer. Well, it's a proven fact that women that don't have a lot of children have a higher risk of breast cancer. Do lesbians have a higher risk of breast cancer? We don't know because we've never asked. Anyway, so the Institute of Medicine felt like we had to ask the questions to find out. And after a significant amount of lobby effort by the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, the Healthy People 2010 document stated that we would indeed ask the question in the last year, have you had intercourse with men, women, both, or neither? And what they stated was is that Healthy People 2010 is the Health and Human Services Department of the federal government. It is their statement that said this is going to guide all money we spend for the next 10 years on all research. So in other words, if you're asking for research money from us, we'll give it to you, but you have to ask that question. Have you had sex with men, women, both, or neither in the last year? And the significance of that is using that information, we could then find out the answers to a lot of these questions about prostate cancer, breast cancer, cardiovascular health, you know, how that would affect the gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender community. And so it's really important. Well, the significance of that is the Health and Human Services Department agreed to put that in the Healthy People 2010 document. But in the last year and a half, the Bush administration reversed that decision. They said, we don't really think this follows kind of what we think the government needs to be doing. And so, you know, they did not want us to have figures on what percentage of the population truly was gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered. And they certainly didn't want to know about our health.
Right.
And if we don't know the answers to those questions, we can't answer where we need to be spending money.
Right.
That's the problem with this AIDS vaccine research that was done. It was a promising idea. And we all know that it's obvious to everybody in the medical field that blacks are more susceptible to the AIDS vaccine. I mean, not to AIDS vaccine, to AIDS virus, the HIV virus, than whites are. Because their rates of getting it are twice as high, three times as high. And we don't know why. Mm-hmm. But the significance of this vaccine is that, granted, for some reason, this vaccine seemed to work better in blacks, but we don't know why. And we don't know for sure if whether that actually happened, or whether it's just a fluke of the research with those particular, because there weren't enough people.
Yeah.
They didn't put enough blacks, they didn't put enough Hispanics, they didn't put enough Asian Americans in the study. They just asked for volunteers, and it turned out that 85% of them were white. Mm-hmm. They needed to have a larger percentage of other groups. They say, well, we think that within a 2% error rate, we're 98% sure.
Right.
That it works better in blacks. Well, in medical research, we really like to say it's 99.5% sure.
Right.
And in other words, it would have taken four times as many blacks. Uh-huh. It would have taken a lot more Asian Americans. You know, unfortunately, the AIDS vaccine did not look like it's going to be promising, except possibly in this particular AIDS vaccine. There's like 20 vaccines out there.
Right, yeah.
And there's a lot of studies that are starting. The HIV virus is a very sneaky little virus, and it's going to be very hard to make a vaccine for. But, you know, the fact is, this may be more beneficial.
Yeah.
But we don't know if we don't ask the right questions.
Right.
So the significance of that study tells us we have to ask the right questions. And the Bush administration is saying we don't want to ask the right questions about gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender health because we don't want to know the answers. We want to stick our head in the sand, and we don't want anybody to know the percentage of the population out there that's really gay,
right,
lesbian, bisexual, transgendered. And that's what that would tell us.
Yeah. And that would also provide, you know, the numbers to know what exactly we're dealing with.
Right. You know, and you know, when I open The Advocate or when I open some of our other magazines, and it's obvious to me that the cigarette companies are targeting our population.
Right.
And it makes me mad. You know, the only question is, are they being successful? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. And we need to ask these questions. And it really upsets me. Another little thing the Bush administration did last year that really chaps my rear is Health and Human Services grants money annually. They say, okay, next year we're going to fund this.
Mm-hmm.
They don't just drop money on the table. They say, okay, we plan to give you money next year.
Yeah.
And every year they do that, you know, to different groups. Well, the lesbian health...
Didn't they commit like $181,000 to
To a lesbian health conference. It is the only conference, you know, for lesbian health researchers. The only one in the country. And guess what? 2 weeks before the conference, they said, we don't really think this fits our agenda. And they pulled out.
Yeah. Now, and see, that's what's crazy because had they told them a year ago, there could have been a contingency plan.
Right.
But because they were counting on that money and had, in effect, already spent that money, just like you would if your boss came up to you and said, you know, Ken or Glenn or Jack or Joan, in, you know, it's December right now or it's September right now, but next year on March 15th, I'm going to give you a $10,000 bonus. You might already go out and spend that money because you think, okay, you know, I'm getting a $10,000 bonus on March 15th. And then if on March 1st, he says, oh, guess what? You're not getting one after all. You might suddenly find yourself $10,000 in debt.
Anyway, you know, it's just very frustrating because I don't generally think of health as being... It should not be politicized.
But that's all it's been under the Bush administration.
It's certainly looking that way.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, the condom reference is removed from Health and Human Services website.
Yes, it was.
We can go on and on.
It was. They have agreed to spend more money internationally.
But they're cutting funds here.
But they're cutting funds here. And the question is, okay, the funds that they're spending here, they're saying they're going to use on abstinence-only education, i.e., don't have sex until you get married. Excuse me. Okay, if you're not going to let me have sex till I get married, let me get married.
I know.
They're not even letting us get married. Okay, well, you know, that's...
There's also been rumors, and this is strictly rumors, but... Even some of the money going overseas is going overseas as part of faith-based initiatives, which people have said is more about proselytization than actually doing anything for anybody.
You know, we started this talking about the 2000 census and how it asked, you know, is this adult in your household, you know, someone that you consider a significant partner? Well, guess what the Bush administration wants to do? They don't like that question. They want to take it out. They do recognize, though, that they don't really have... It's too early to take it out of the 2010 census.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're still in office in 2008, it'll be history.
Yeah, well, let's hope they're not.
Well, you know, I'm very frustrated from a doctor, from a medical standpoint.
Now, give people, once again, information on Lobby Day. Where do they need to meet you?
Okay, well, on Lobby Day, they can get on the www.hglpc.org website, and they can pay with using a check electronically or a MasterCard, Visa, Discover, whatever, using PayPal. And the bus that goes down and comes back the same day is $25. The bus that goes down and spends the night and comes back the next day is $75. If you share a room, if you want a private room, it's $100. And or you can just send a check to us. Our P.O. box is 66664. It's four sixes and a four. At Houston, Texas, 77266. And we will then get back with you and tell you where the bus is going to leave from. And it'll be in a Montrose location, fairly secure, so you don't have to worry about your car.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking to Ken Jones, president of the Houston Lesbian and Gay Political Caucus and retired MD. And you are listening to Queer Voices.
Guess there's no use in hanging around. Guess I'll get dressed and do the town. I'll find some crowded avenue, though it will be empty without you. Can't get used to losing you, no matter what I try to do. Gonna live my whole life through loving you. Some guy I used to know. After I heard him say hello, couldn't think of anything to say. Since you're gone, it happens every day. Can't get used to losing you, no matter what I try to do. Gonna live my whole life through loving you. I'll find somebody, wait to see. Who am I kidding? Only me. 'Cause no one else could take your place. Guess that I am just a helpless case. Can't get used to losing you, no matter what I try to do. Gonna live my whole life through loving you. I can't get used to losing you, no matter what I try to do. Gonna live loving you.
From his 1999 album Inside Out, that was Cam Clark, Can't Get Used to Losing You. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, I'm Joan Devlin, and I have in the studio James, Jericho, and Tiffany, and they are part of the Montrose Writers Guild. And James, tell us a little bit about the Montrose Writers Guild.
Well, we started last semester in the fall of 2002, and there are four of us actually, but the fourth facilitator couldn't be here tonight. And we started, we're graduate students at the University of Houston in the Creative Writing Program. And we decided that we really wanted to do some outreach into the community and to really kind of see what kind of voices are out here in Houston. And to bring our expertise to the table, really. Mm-hmm. So we decided that we'd band together and see what we could do to help our community.
So what was it like, Jericho? Was it what you expected? A little better, a little worse?
It hasn't been what I expected. What I'm mostly interested in is hearing a lot of
a lot of the stories that I think still need to be told, whether it's through poetry or fiction, I think there's still, no matter how much you watch Will and Grace or whatever you watch, there's still a lot of silence going on. And I don't know, I know what it was like to pick up literature about myself before I even knew that it was about myself.
Right.
And I want to afford other people that kind of opportunity. And so I really look forward to seeing more people come through. We had a set group that's really coming to see us, but I'm glad we can be on this show and more people can hear about it so that they can bring us their stuff and we can groom it to be what it is at its best, you know?
Right.
So.
And that's a good question, because I think a lot of people, especially I know writers, artists, because you pour so much of yourself into your work, sometimes you're kind of hesitant to put it in front of somebody because you're afraid they're either not going to get it, they're going to tear it up. And I would think with GLBT people, sometimes you get almost more of that because we are accustomed in many ways to keeping parts of ourselves locked up. So have you seen any of that, Tiffany? Has anybody been hesitant to show their work?
I would say we've had a few people who have been a little hesitant in being, I think, real straightforward. Like Jericho was saying, I'd like to see more people trying to really talk about what's, you know, what the experiences and things. I think the three of us together have had a lot of experience in telling our own stories, and but we're trying to make this group a real supportive and encouraging voices, encouraging more GLBT people to be not afraid. We're not going to tear people apart in this group. We're not going to do those sorts of things. This is a real supportive atmosphere, and anybody who wants to write and get their voice out there, that's what we're looking for. So, but like Jericho, I'd love to see more, you know.
But even beyond that, I just want to say real quick, it's not like everything that somebody brings in has something to do with sexuality. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a few months ago we had a guy who's writing a science fiction novel, which had nothing to do with sexuality at all, as I remember. You know, some people are writing about their family, some people are writing about growing up, some people are writing about their cats, their dogs, their plants, and that's okay as well.
Well, I want to say I review books for the Triangle, and one of the books I remember it's called "Turn Me Into Zeus's Daughter," and it was about a girl who grew up straight. Her whole family, you know, there was no gay content whatsoever, but her thing was, because of severe malnutrition as a child, her face was deformed, and so she always felt different. And there were so many things, even though, you know, I never had to go through the extreme poverty or anything that she suffered. You know, these were literally dirt poor people, lived in houses with no electricity, whole nine yards. There was so much in that book I could relate to, just based on the fact that she continually felt like an outsider because of her family's extreme poverty, because of her face. You know, so it doesn't, you're right, it doesn't have to be about being GLBT. There's universal themes that we can all relate to regardless of our experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But we also do encourage people to write about whatever they'd like. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think most often, especially with younger queer writers, what they don't write about is what they really want to write about. And that often becomes subtext for stories. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, the outcast plant or the put out bottle or whatever they're writing about often has a subtext of sexuality, because of course we are compelled to be silent as queer people. So it's very interesting that we have this interplay, I think, especially with younger queer writers, and which is most of what we have right now coming. But we'd really like to see some older queer writers come out too, because that's a whole fabulous different perspective.
Well, every generation has their own stories to tell.
Absolutely. There's mythos that create our own generations, and we have different stories. That's great.
And what's the male-to-female ratio? Is there been a pretty good, you know, mix? Or because unfortunately, a lot of things like this, you tend to get more women or more men. You don't ever seem to have just an even mix.
I'd say right now, we're more women right now.
Yeah. Which is wonderful.
Which is great for me, because I'm the one facilitator who's female. So we have three male facilitators, but right now we have more women. But it's gone, you know, back and forth, I think, depending on who shows up which week.
So. Now, how does it work? Do you give assignments out, or do people just bring you what they've come up with? Do you ask them to write a certain theme, or is it just kind of free form? How do you kind of run the group? So, you know, if people are interested in joining, you know, just to kind of give them an idea, if they show up, what should they expect?
They should expect whatever they kind of bring as well to the group. We've designed it so that people can just dive right in, you know, just come. Some people do bring some things, and we certainly devote some time to the people who are writing outside of the group and wanting feedback, wanting comments. And then there are times when we do write exercises, which are always a lot of fun and always sort of playful and really get people into the word, mm-hmm. into language, which is really what we're sort of about. We love language. All three of us really, really mm-hmm. love language.
Oh, Jerry goes over there making faces.
We also bring in other literature that's yes. already published, already written. And this is so important. It's important that people see, you know, that this is going on, the mm-hmm. stuff's out there, so it can be done, you know.
And in this world, I mean, I think in some ways creative writing is almost a dying art, because the new thing now is reality, reality, reality. Everything has to be nonfiction and gritty and real and real. And, you know, today, oddly enough, would have been the 98th birthday or 99th birthday of Dr. Seuss. And Dr. Seuss was definitely not about reality, mm-hmm. yet he created an absolutely wonderful world that has appealed to people gay and straight, you know, for many, many years now. So what do you think about this? You know, do you think there needs to be some encouragement out there for people to search within themselves, and instead of just trying to, you know, focus on this reality stuff, maybe actually create a little different dimension for themselves?
Well, yeah, and I think as educators as well, all of us teach as well, and I think it's really important that that people are being taught that creativity is something that they can practice and learn and do. I mean, there's always this, you can't teach writing, so if, mm-hmm. You know, if you're not gifted, you're not gifted. And I think that, you know, anybody can write, and anybody can, everybody has a voice to share. And so I think it's really important in terms of not just reality, but, you know, even in people realizing that there are stories to tell that you can create, whether they're based on reality or not, mm-hmm. doesn't matter. You know, we can create worlds or, you know, build one from what you know.
Well, your imagination is a great escape hatch. And, you know, I think kids today and young people today are not as encouraged to use that as maybe earlier generations might have been. And I don't know why that is. I'm not going to sit there and be like one of these people that bemoans, oh, the youth are falling. I just think the world we live in now is a scarier place, and people learn about some things younger than they used to. People aren't insulated, which in a lot of ways is good, but in some ways it also detracts from that imagination thing.
But everybody hasn't realized that, have they? Everybody hasn't figured out that the stuff we're not talking about, everybody knows.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
You know, things are happening at age 10 that you used to have to be 15 in order for them
right.
to happen, you know?
Right.
And everybody wants to blame it on the hormones we're giving chicken now.
Yeah.
So that it grows faster.
I think somebody at KPFT actually was on the air about that.
Whatever the reason is, yeah. though, we know that things are happening earlier. We know that they're happening faster, right? You know, you could talk to anybody you want to anytime you get ready, on a cell phone or email.
Yeah.
We know that everything is a snap of the finger, right?
Right, exactly.
And if that's
we
the
have
case,
much more access.
Then this is all the more reason.
Mm-hmm.
This is all the more reason to get the stuff down there, right?
Yes.
It's all the more reason for the next person to come, for it to already be said. It's all the more reason for the writing, in the way I see it.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? You know what I mean?
I know. And, you know, you never know. Who could be the next Harry Potter, you know? Who could be the next Dr. Seuss? Yeah. You don't know. Somebody sitting in the, you know, the Montrose Writers Group could come up with the next idea about this little boy who goes to wizard school or something of that nature that suddenly takes the entire world by storm.
And I have to say, as a facilitator and someone who's worked with youth and past and done groups, I've been really, really impressed by some of the writing. I mean, blown out of the water impressed by some of the stuff that happens in our own community under our own noses.
Right.
I think that's so incredibly fabulous that I get to be a part of somebody else's growing.
And just think, you might be the catalyst that, you know, pushes the next J.K. Rowling or Dr. Seuss or, you know, Armistead Maupin to take that next step and send their stuff to a publisher.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely, and hopefully. And I think another thing, you know, sort of bouncing off of what James was saying is, I think that writers are often people who think they have to be alone and think they have to sort of shut themselves in and not share what they're doing. And I think it's really important for writers to also have other writers to talk to and to come out and say, you know, hey, I'm writing too. How are you doing? What's going on? Even, I mean, I think we're also trying to create a community of writers where people don't have to just, you know, shut themselves in front of the computer and not come out and write and
be
talk
a closet
to other
writer.
Writers. Exactly. Yeah. I realize I keep saying that.
So if people want to join the Montrose Writers Guild?
It's the Montrose Writers Project.
Montrose Writers Project Guild. Okay. Montrose Writers. Let's just stop there. What do
union.
They have to do?
I like union.
Unions are good. Don't say union too loud in Texas, though, man.
Okay. What do they have to do? We need the second and fourth Monday every month at the community center, the Queer Community Center here in Houston at 3400 Montrose.
Right. New location.
Yeah. New location. Nice building. Suite 207, I believe it is.
Covered parking.
It's really nice. The window's actually open. You can get some nice cool air in. A little bit too cold right now, but so they just show up at 7 o'clock and bring their writing. Don't bring their writing. Certainly bring, you know, their mind and their want and their desire and all that.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you. We've been talking to James and Jericho and Tiffany. They are part of the Montrose Writers Project, which meets every
second and fourth Monday of the month.
That's why you're here on the first Monday.
Absolutely.
At the new community center on 3400 Montrose. Thank you so much for being here tonight. I appreciate it. Good luck. We'll have to have you back on to keep us posted.
Anytime.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. At the community center?
I don't know the phone number at the community center, but I'll supply you with the email address, and anyone can contact me through that.
Okay. And you are listening to Queer Voices.
When we were young, we knew we were different. We didn't know how or why. And as we grew up, we found what was different was only our dreams and desires. But we learned the names that they had for us. We prayed they would never discover us. And as we waited silently, quietly, we learned them silently. We were not good enough.
good enough, scot-free from his 1999 album, The Living Dead.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
This is Queer Voices.
I'm so glad I know the name of the show.
Yes.
Oh, that's actually pretty good. We have on the phone with us, we have Randall White, who is asking us if we're normal. Definitely.
Yeah, are we normal? I don't think we are.
That sounded like it so far.
And you're calling us from Dallas?
I'm in Dallas currently, right.
Okay, well, that's really too bad.
Not freezing, I hope.
It's a little chilly, but it's all right.
Well, you know, if you live in Houston, you're not supposed to like Dallas.
I know. Well, then you're going to love my show, Normal, because Dallas gets poked at quite often in the show.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about your show, since none of us here are normal.
Right, right. I really, Joan, I enjoyed your segment just now with the Montrose Writers Project Group, because so much of what they talked about and what you talked about getting your voice out there and trying to get those universal themes that we can all relate to, that's how this project started out. About 2 years ago, I decided to hang up my suits and return to a profession that I had been trained to, but that I had abandoned in my 20s because I was full of fear, and began writing and performing again, and wrote a one-man show that I called Normal, and began producing it and touring it almost 2 years ago, and next week it comes to Houston.
Now, how many different people do you play in this one-woman show? Because I had a press release that it's over 100 or something.
Oh, no. I do 11.
11. Well, that's a lot.
That's still a lot. In about 100 minutes. I think one of the slogans we use is one actor, 11 character, 100 nonstop minutes. So.
Sounds a little bit about, like, Greater Tuna.
Well, it has been actually a reviewer once likened to a socially conscious Greater Tuna. Mostly because, everything except the difference is I don't exit the stage and I don't have really extraordinary costume changes like those guys do, but I do transform in front of the audience from each of these characters, and they're very varied. And on surface, you'd think they're not related, but as time goes on, you begin to go, oh, this guy is that person that they just talked about a while ago. And I don't use as many props or costumes. I use minimal pieces. It really allows the audience, I think, to go along with the character development that happens instead.
I see on your website, which is abbetuck.com.
Yeah, you can also get to it by normaltheplay.com. We'll also take you there.
Okay. And one of your idols, of course, is Janice Ian.
Oh, my God. She's a remarkable woman. I decided on the website to identify some people that I have a great deal of respect for. And Janice Ian is definitely one of those people.
Well, and certainly, I mean, her songs go back to the 60s on Top 40 radio,
right.
Oh, yes.
When in fact they were banned.
Oh, sure.
Society's Child.
Well, and her most recent album talks about the whole story about her song God in the FBI. It just completely wipes me out because it talks about all that kind of paranoia that was imposed upon us, or has been, or may be still, by the government. And she's just a remarkable voice for many years. You know.
Where do you take your characters from?
Well, it all started out with a good friend of mine, a sculptor friend of mine, who was trying to coax me back onto the stage. I was hemming and hawing about that a little bit. I had just my partner of 13 years had died from cancer. I was working a full-time job with a very, very well-known national health organization. I myself had just been diagnosed with cancer, and I decided maybe I was getting some messages that I needed. I had the opportunity to hop off that escalator and get on another one. And a sculptor friend of mine said I needed to get back on stage, and I said, oh, I don't know. And he says, you also need to write, and I went, oh, I don't know. And he said, you have these social characters, these people you do at social events and with your friends. You have these personas that you channel. Write something for them to say and put them on stage. And that's really how it began. At first I thought, well, what a whimsical idea. And then I thought about my redneck. And then I thought about my screaming queen. And then I thought about my southern dilettante. And I began thinking, what can these people all talk about? And what can I get them to do? And that's when the idea of normal